All right, welcome to this edition of Nyuki Podcast. Today we are doing a little bit different. We have a privilege to have someone that you guys are going to discover in this interview. Someone who's going to interview us instead. I think you guys have used to us interviewing people, but we are going to be the one answering the question this time.
Yes.
And we are here today. Well, before I introduce our special guest interviewer of the evening or the day, depending where you're going to, what time you are watching, I'm here with Uncle Theo. Uncle T.
Hello, this is Theo. I'm here with Spani. Like you mentioned, today is going to be very different compared to what we have been doing these past episodes. This time we won't be the one asking questions, it will be the one being asked questions.
Yes.
But I think it will be also nice to, when we introduce our host or our interviewer, why we decided to do this way.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just somebody that we picked up from out of nowhere, but somebody that's interested in something, and that's why we decided to do it that way. I won't say you how what, but hopefully he'll be able to tell us why he chose to interview us.
You want
us
to go a little bit into his background, or you want him to do that?
He'll do the background, because you know I want to do justice to his background. I don't want to miss out anything or misinform people.
All right.
Yeah. Walter, welcome.
Welcome to Nyuki, Walter.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. Mm-hmm. It's a privilege to be here. I want to interview you because I know you have stories. Everyone has stories, but
yes.
I think you have some really important things to share about being not only an immigrant, but the refugee from some of the problems that are plaguing the Congo and Burundi and the surrounding area.
Yeah.
So I got started doing immigrant stories 17 years ago in Glenwood Springs to try to tell a story of the new immigrants who were Latinos.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of the story was to help people understand the humanity. It's harder to objectify a person if you know their story.
Mm-hmm.
So storytelling is really powerful, as I've learned from sitting with people who I didn't know when I first started with them. You know, walk in and we're strangers, and when we leave, we are much closer. And I think that's true of storytelling. It's powerful, and it can make a difference. And I think it does. I think people are less likely to treat others as others, treat other people as objectives, and understand them much better. So one of the things that I did in Glenwood Springs was not only tell the story of the new immigrants, but to talk to some of the people that I've known. I grew up in Glenwood Springs, so I knew a lot of people who I knew. We had a large group of Italians who came into the area back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and they settled, and they did a lot of the work that the next generation of immigrants did. So by telling the old stories and the new stories together, I think it helped those that had been around for a while understand, that's not that much different than my grandfather's story.
Yeah.
So I think that's an important thing. I think that's part of what you guys are doing too, is to shine the light on members of your community and let people know, you know, the people who are making a difference in the African immigrant community.
Yes.
Questions of me?
And you mentioned that you have been working on the story of immigrant for 17 years now. But overall, for our viewer, how long you have been in broadcasting industry?
It wasn't anything that I knew much about. So when I got interested in trying to tell immigrant stories, mm-hmm. I went to the local radio station and they helped train me.
Oh, nice.
It's a community access radio mm-hmm. station. KDNK is one of those jewels. Mm-hmm. Community access radio is a great part of our democracy, you know, where people can come in off the street and like me and with an idea and end up with a program. So thanks to KDNK for all that they did to make it possible. And they've helped. They've run the program for 17 years.
Nice. Oh, nice. That's really nice. Yeah. So, story of immigrant. All right.
Well, my father was an immigrant from Scotland, so he came when he was a baby. And so that's another aspect of my history that has made me sensitive to the immigrant experience and the immigrant story. Mm-hmm. And I know that you came from the Congo.
Yes.
The Democratic Republic of
Congo.
Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like growing up there?
Wow. I would say Congo, back then, it was way different than what it is now. It was much more calm and quiet, I would say, safe than what we have been experiencing for the last couple of decades.
What year were you born?
1991.
Okay.
Yeah.
So things were just starting. Things had changed.
Yeah, things
in
has
1960,
changed.
Right?
1960, yeah.
When Lumumba was there.
Yeah, when the
in that short time that he was there.
He was there. Yeah, I think even though he was assassinated and moving forward to Mobutu's taking control and taking over the country, I would say the country was much better compared to what we are looking at today. Based on history and what my parents have told me, that back then, at that time, they were able to attend to school safely, eat three times a day, people are working, the country was saved. You know, even though he was a dictator, but the economy was stable and the country was, it was secure, like, nothing was going on like what we have been experiencing.
Did you grow up in the country? Were you in a city as a kid?
Well, in the city, but I've also my parents have also been moving because my father was a diplomat, and so every then and then you get transferred to another country,
right.
So it kind of go from country to another. So we kind of did not have a lot compared to, say, a lot of the background to say, like, I was just in one city in Congo and this is where my identity come from. I cannot say that because
so
we have been like a nomad.
So you were in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Did you move around? What other countries have you been to?
Oh, well, I would say my parents moved from Congo, Burundi, Rwanda, Central African Republic. Yeah, those three countries were the main countries that my parents, because my dad kind of
we're about to know you today because
explore those
be
region more. I would say this is the perfect
time.
Word I would describe it. Explore those region more, and he kind of was an expert into that. So
the son of a diplomat. That's yeah. He did move around.
Yeah.
Theo, what about you? What was young boyhood like for you?
So with me, I wasn't born in where I'm from. I wasn't born in Burundi. My parents were born there and are from there, and I am from there. But in 1972, they moved to Rwanda. In 1972, there was a genocide happened in Burundi targeting Hutus.
So they didn't just move, they had to flee.
Oh, yeah, they had no choice but to flee. Yeah, that's the best way to put it. To Rwanda for 1972, and we did not, we left. I'm not exactly sure for how long, what year, but they were there for about 20 years as refugees.
Can you explain a little bit about what happened in Burundi that forced people to flee? What was the trouble?
We have three ethnicities, and one really is, nobody's talking about it, is the two that are fighting, always fighting. So the Twas, who are originally Burundians, also Rwandans, they're less than 1% right now. And then there's Hutus, which are majority in Rwanda and Burundi. And then there are Tutsis. So in 1972, the Tutsis were the one in power. And then I really don't know exactly what happened, but you know, there's the stories are there, and I can't get into that right now. But basically, those in power who have power to eliminate the other people that did not look like them. But you know, it's crazy. So that's what happened. The ones in power wanted to kill the other ones. I'm sure they have their own defense why they want to do right.
You were born in Rwanda.
Yeah, I was born in Rwanda in 1993, right before the genocide in Rwanda.
In a refugee camp? Were in a refugee camp?
I was born in the city, but my parents lived in the refugee camp. But then around that time, 20 years, you get used to the country, you be technically a citizen, even though you're not a citizen. Now, right. They still knew they were Burundians, they were refugees, but they're conducting business as if they were, yeah.
Wow. Spani, what was going on in your time? In 1991, things were starting to really change.
Yeah. I think it was, we started, but well, based on history and what I've heard, we started seeing, a change of new head of state across the whole African continent. And I think it was more that the Western society got tired of Mobutu's reign because he was in power for nearly 32 years. And I think it was time for change. And they ended up took him out. So when they did that, everyone that was involved or who had a close, maybe no relationship, but I would say a close where's the perfect word I'm trying to use? Like that was in his group of government. So a lot of the people that were who has access, I would say, let's put it, access to classified document or high ranking inside the government.
Right.
All those people were a high target for the new government that was coming into power, including my dad also, because he was also a high-ranking member, but he was more as a diplomat. That would be his undercover identity.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
So knowing a lot, and so he was also a target for the new government when he came in, and he was one of the people that they end up going after as well.
So you were just a baby at that point, right? I mean, you, how old were you when your father started to realize that it was going to be different for him?
I would say, well, when I got the hang of everything, I was about 10 years old.
Right. That's usually when you start to get the hang of
it. Yeah, that's when I noticed that, okay, our lifestyle is crashing. Everything that we knew is no longer is going to be what the type of life you used to have.
Give me an example of that. When was there a day or a time when you went, something happened and you realized?
Well, I would say it's all started, let me say it this way. You know, as a diplomat, you are in a different country. In order, if let's say your job is over, your government has to get you and your family to take everybody back mm-hmm. home.
Right.
But that didn't happen in case of my father. So we were in Central Africa Republic. Then he got a letter of termination.
Oh, so it was just like he was supposed to just take care of himself.
Yeah, so he kind of got left out there.
He was abandoned.
Yeah, so that was the first
thing. Yeah, that would be
that happened.
An eye-opener.
Yeah.
So the whole family was in turmoil then.
Yeah.
And afraid.
Mm-hmm. And then he said that he didn't want it to go back to Congo to fight it. So he asked my mom to take some of us, because we were younger, to go back to the Department of State in Congo, in Kinshasa, and fight it, because she's a woman. Regardless, there's going to be a mercy. It's like we have the assumption of not touching a woman, you know. So that was thinking behind.
She was guard. She could go there with impunity, not be afraid or not be attacked.
And he was going to stay back in Central Africa Republic with my oldest brother and some of our cousin that was with us.
Right.
So as we were going, there was an operation that came of military group that came from Congo to Central Africa Republic, arrested him there as we were, and they flew him back to Congo.
And left the family?
Yeah, left the family without a resource or with nothing. So when we got to Congo, no one knew where he was. Even the people in Congo, his family member in Congo, didn't know that he was already back in Congo.
So you're 10 years old and you don't know where your dad has been taken.
Yes. But when he got there, he was put underground in prison. And one of the, I would say, of the prison employer knew my father, and he kind of snitched.
So he gave your father.
He gave up the information that this is where they're hiding him, and he was with another person there, and he begged that his identity and his name not to be revealed because his life would be also in danger.
So, do you have brothers and sisters? Was it a whole who was part of the family that was going through this with you?
All of us were we were going to that, but it would be my third older brother, my sister, myself, and my younger brother and my little sister. So the two older ones were the ones that remained in Central Africa, because they were already adult and they were in the age of where they could take you know, they can be seen as a threat.
Really intense.
Yeah. So yeah. So and to the second part, that when it got released, he told us that Congo is not safe, that we have to leave. We end up fleeing Congo in middle of the night to cross the river to get to the other Congo Brazzaville in the middle of the night. So yeah.
Who helped you? Did you have people?
Who helped us?
No, I don't need names. I've just you had people who were helping get you across.
We do, like I said at the beginning, that my dad has an identity of, so he kind of had.
Yeah, he was living another part of his life.
So yeah, he kind of had people that he knew that were inside the custom border. That's I can so.
So he could approach custom agents and and they would
the one that they knew each other to kind of get my family out of and all these things because.
So did he make it out? Did he?
He did not.
Sorry.
Yeah. That was the sad part about that whole situation, because that was the last time we all saw him. So
sorry, man.
Yeah.
So how did you move on from that? Was your mother able to bring you all together? How did that work?
Yeah, she did. She did. You know, it's not easy at that time, being a single mom plus a widow, having 7 kids, try to raise by herself. It's not like today's day where women are more working and becoming more independently. But back then, that wasn't the case. Everything was, the man was doing everything, the husband was the main provider, so it was a little bit hard navigating back when we went back to Central Africa Republic. Tried now to live the life that where we used to live, to now move to a ghetto where rents are cheap. And
so you went from the life of a diplomat to just trying to get by.
Exactly. So yeah, and with that, that kind of took affected to, yeah, most of us, which we kind of lost 2 years of schooling.
Yeah, school doesn't really matter when you're trying to stay alive.
Yeah. So
Theo, so you're living a similar life, trying to run from what, from the hatred of ethnic cleansing.
Yeah, so after, you know, the 20 years, so this whole thing, like in Rwanda, Burundi, and Congo, Uganda too, where they have politically, is this one group is leading, and then those who are in exile also plotting to go back and overthrow the current government and then take over. So it's like this little cycle. So Burundi and Rwanda is like either one, in Rwanda the Tutsis leading the country, and then in Rwanda the Hutus are leading the country, or the Hutus are leading the country in Burundi, and then the Tutsis are leading the country in Rwanda. So it's always there. I have in both, especially those two countries, there's never where the one ethnicity is both running the country at the same time, either Rwanda or Burundi. And in Congo is the same thing, but I don't think it's based on ethnicities. Also in Uganda is the same thing, ethnicities or I would say tribes. And so when my parents left in 1972 to go, when they flee, trying to escape, the Tutsis were leading the country then. And then in Rwanda, the Hutus were leading the country. And then that went on for a long time. But during that time, in Rwanda, the Tutsis were plotting to take to overthrow the government, and the Tutsis they were living in Uganda. So those Rwandans were working with the current government right now. Museveni, that they helped him overthrow one government. And then after they overthrew the government, he told them like, oh no, they told him like, okay, it's nice that you have your own home, you know, you got what you wanted. And it's nice that we have really nice positions in your government, but we want to go home. So he helped them also overthrow the government. And that was right before the genocide in 1994. So during that time, the government and at the time called rebels were fighting back and forth. So my parents, we along with others, they knew like something bad is about to happen. So I was born during that time.
Yeah, you were born into it.
I was born into it. I was actually born at the soldiers' camp in Kigali. Yes, soldiers' camp.
What year was that?
1993. So that's like few months before
it starts to crest.
Yes, either a year or a few months before everything. So my parents knew.
Your parents are terrified.
Oh yes.
Your mother in particular, who's pregnant with you, and
On the way to the hospital, and then right by the soldiers' camp, and then. Also in Burundi during that time, that's when they were about to elect the first Hutu president. So it was crazy. They knew like we can't stay in Rwanda, even though we are going to Burundi, because there was also this thing like, okay. So my parents went to Burundi, and then my mom stayed in Burundi with us, but my dad continued. And he went to Congo. Because he knew as soon as they elect this first Hutu president in Burundi, mm-hmm. something is going to happen. Which happened, they killed him. He didn't even spend I don't know how many months as a president.
Not really.
Yeah. And then so after that we went to Congo. And then after that we spent about 2-3 years in Congo, and then 1990.
So how old were you then? In Congo, how old were you?
So in Congo, I was either one, two. I was two. So we went, I was still one. And we left, I was two or three.
So it was just a series of moves to stay alive, to have your family safe.
Yeah. And then, so... In 1996, and after 1994, then the genocide has happened already in Rwanda, and then the current government, which is the government now, they're like, okay, we're going to go against those that committed genocides, because the genocide, the target were Tutsi in Rwanda, so it kind of reversed. Also, during the 1993, the president, including others, at this time, they were killing each other. Yeah, so after the genocide, the current government went after those that committed genocide in Rwanda. They went after them.
Yeah.
So my parents were like, it's also not safe to be here. So, and then they... even that, it was a journey. We didn't go at the same time. It was another journey. I remember
One thing I never forgot is one of I call her my grandmother, who's the mother to my auntie, the wife of my uncle. She's the one that helped us and my sisters, or my some of my siblings, to go to Tanzania. And she, like, we were in the boat, and imagine these woody boats, and you have
they were wooden boats with tarps on them.
No, they didn't have tarps on them, but we have it was not a this ceiling thing we have, I don't know what it's called in Africa, but we just put it on top of us, and then because it was raining too at the same time,
like that's a tarp.
It was a tap, but those tap that you put in the house. Oh. Yeah. So we put him. So then I was three. I was 3 years old. And I still remember that as going through Lake Tanganyika, going to Tanzania.
In the rain.
Yes.
Trying to find someplace.
Trying to escape, yes. And but then, because so all there, they also had a strategy of, okay, we cannot be in the same area. We cannot move at the same time. So my dad went to Tanzania first, just like he did in Congo, because there were targets, you know, of men. Like, you know, as a man, you had to escape away. You couldn't be with your family, so you had to find a different way. But like, you know, a child with their mother. Actually, with my younger sister. Like, she was literally born, like, then and there, and then they start hitting shots.
In the middle of when things started.
Like, my mom is giving birth to my younger sister and start hearing shots. So,
They even cut the umbilical cord.
Yeah, so she's carrying her, running, trying to escape.
Really?
Yeah.
Jesus. And you're...
I was three. Dan. Yeah.
Yeah.
And those are the stories. Those are the little story we know. They our parents never tell us everything.
Full story.
Because right. I don't think they want us to
experience or live through the trauma.
Not only do they not want you to experience it, they don't want to experience it again by the telling. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yes.
Leave it be.
Why it has been.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry you guys had to experience that as young people.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, I wasn't 10 like him, because I'm sure he has a lot of memories. With me, I don't remember much. Most of the things that I know is...
You're probably lucky you were younger.
I'm very grateful I don't remember anything. Yeah.
Bonnie, when did it start to feel like you were safe? I mean, you were then trying to just get by, and your mom was trying to keep you all healthy and alive.
Yeah, I would say when we made it to Central African Republic to reunite with the rest of our siblings that were there, I think that's when we knew that, okay, all of us are here, but our dad is not here. And to say when did we feel safe, I would say maybe after he passed away, and when... Kabila, the father, was assassinated.
How did you know when he had passed? Did you get word?
Well, at that time, there was a way of communication, but it's not like what we have today. It was like you have to make an appointment to a call station. And yes, in French, they call a phony. So it's like, let's say here I have a network, a way to receive call and make call in all the part of the country. So here I will, I come in and I pay that, hey, I want to request on this day, let's say on Wednesday, I want to talk to so-and-so at this time in this country. And then we arrange that and send a message out there and to get that person that on Wednesday at this time, you need to come to our station, so-and-so want to talk to you. So even when it was, my dad was sick, we didn't knew because lack of communication until when he passed away. Then we ended up hearing the news maybe a week after he passed away. That's when we got the news in Central African Republic.
But and you're not really ever sure. Were you sure how he passed? Was he you said he was sick. Was it because he was being...
He was poisoning inside the prison when he was arrested. So, yeah. It was one of those poison that kind of take time. So, for him, I think within 6 months period, that's when everything happened. The moment he got arrested, when we got to Congo, a month and a half later, and then my mom put a lot of pressure. He got released. When he got released, he wanted us to leave right away. Didn't want us to stay. But we managed to at least spend at least, I would say, a month or two top with him before the plan to escape was executed that middle of the night. And
he was too sick to he couldn't go with you anyway.
I don't think he knew or no one knew he was sick. Because when he was released, he was under heavy surveillance. He couldn't go anywhere. So they were following him. There were people camping outside of our house, just following his movement. Because, like I say, he was really a high-ranking
person of interest
in terms of security and all these things, right. The region. So he kind of knew a lot.
He was a marked man.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that's what happened. And it was also too late when the news broke out for my mom to even try to go attend the funeral. None of us did attend the funeral I've ever.
Well, it's probably pretty dangerous, right? I mean, to...
At that time, I would say the younger we were, we would have been okay. But I think my brothers would be...
So the older you were, the more you became a target.
And that's why most of us, we do not have the same last name. So,
by design.
But yeah, so it's all.
So that you wouldn't carry your father's name because.
Yeah. So if they start looking for who are your kids, you don't have the same last name with your kids. Type of deal. Because from my older sister to my younger brother, we have different last name compared to my three previous older brothers. So
how long were you in this state where you were trying to stay alive and stay safe?
In Central African Republic, we stayed there for a long time after everything happened. We stayed there until I was 17. So for 7 years in Central African Republic.
How did your mom engineer your move from Africa to the United States? Was it her?
You asked her because when my dad got arrested in Central African Republic, my mom went to, it would be UNESCO. I think there's UNICEF. There's all those international
agencies.
Were there to raise awareness to this situation. How can a diplomat in a foreign country and also a foreign troop come out of execute and arrest in? So you was kind of. There was a lot of plot from the Congolese government and the Central African government as well to kind of make that happen, because we all know a foreign army to come in and execute and arrest in a foreign country, it's right. A top level classification phone call approval to allow that plane to land it and right. coordinate this is where the house is,
lots of other countries,
there's all those things that when we think about it and you just look what it means to be a diplomat, and when you start going down along the line you can see it wasn't just anything or light situation, it was something that was heavy involved from the people in top in Congo, a Congolese government with the Central African government. It was kind of connected.
Well, and we know from studying history that in the 60s and 70s that the United States, for example, was heavily involved in that area.
Yeah.
And engineering some of these. They were part of the Lumumba assassination. So
yeah.
There's other people in other countries who
want to control them. Yeah, so that was the beginning of it. And when she went to those international body, and I think it was a coroner there that kind of told her, openly told her that I understand what you are going to, like, there's nothing that we can do. It didn't come from us. It came from higher top that is above his pay grade at that time. But he kind of told her about to apply for
part of the lottery at that point? Or
no. Our first attempt to asylum seeking was to go to Netherlands. That was the first one that we applied and we didn't get that.
So your mom started started looking for asylum.
Yeah.
Given what had happened to you.
Because we couldn't go back to Congo. And
you
also
didn't have a country.
Yeah, exactly. So that was our first one. We didn't get it. Then second one, I think it was Canada. We didn't get that one either. Then the third one it was United States that accepted us then. Yeah.
Theo, what was your chronology? How did you make your way? I mean, your dad was always sort of one step ahead. tell me about him. How did he know to engineer these moves?
With this one, I don't think he did, because when we went to the camp and settled in Tanzania, that's when some of those international agencies took notes, like, you know, how many people are in the camps and when did you get here, they kind of gather all the information. And then so they decided those that left Burundi in 1972, you know, having been gone for that long, they don't have anywhere to go anymore. Even if they did have anywhere to go, I don't think they have any plots or any place since 1972. So they picked those names, and then that's how we got here. Those that left Burundi in 1990. Those that left flee Burundi in 1972.
Really? So those people were high priority?
Yes, those people were picked to come here. Before that, a few years back, there's some other countries, like if my dad was home at the time they were looking for him,
would have been, I believe, in Sweden. But he wasn't home, thank God. But so after years later, then, because also the camp at Tanzania got to the point where they kind of got tired of keeping refugees. Because if you go back, those camps now are closed.
Right.
Yeah, so they would, okay, can you go home? You can't go home. So I think that's how, you know, it happened. Like, okay, there's nowhere these people can go. And then I think the UN and then all the international agencies.
So your stories are similar in that regard. You were without a country. You couldn't go back to a place because it wasn't safe.
Yeah. With them, it's kind of different in a way. Like with us, at the time, we started claiming that it was safe. But then, even though it's safe, where are you gonna go? You left 1972. Somebody has taken over your land.
It's gone.
Or like, I don't have anybody anymore.
So, like you said, not only your land. If you don't have your land and your home and you're sort of invisible. You become invisible.
Yeah. So I think, because some people started going back to Burundi. And then even some people were picked like, nah, I don't think I'll go to America. I'll just go back home. You know, they give you the choice. And then with us, like, yeah, no, we had.
Was your dad hunted? You said.
No, my dad was just a normal, ordinary businessman. He was not involved in other things. It's just those things that happen. When something happened, like when governments or rebels go against government or government being overthrown. So, like, for instance, this incident that happened. Mobutu being overthrown, a lot of people were scattered. But then I think with them it was more of we just want to take over the government. And then with us, it's more like we're killing almost everybody. So it's from the ordinary person. Majority is ordinary people.
It's just a melee. Everybody was being killed.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. When somebody asks you about your childhood, you know, do you have fond memories of your childhood? I mean, it's like it was taken from you.
I would say, for most part, I can pick and choose in between to say what I want to remember as a fond childhood growing up. Or
what are those memories?
Those memories would be, having my whole family in one house, our dad is there, mom, that the weekend, wake up, he's the one getting everybody in the car, let's go get her cat, or you call a barber, come to the house, and this weekend or you're going to visit family member with them.
Even in the midst of war and that kind of fear, there were times where it was just a normal everyday. That's what you're describing, where things are normal, people are together.
It has to be before the war and everything started going south in that regard.
Yeah.
So I think after I crossed that mark of 10, it wasn't fun like it was anymore. It was more like, okay, I'm trying to play this off so that I don't think about this. Let me acquire a new friend, or let me... Now we're in different environment, different neighborhood. Now let's start, adapting to this new way of life that we have never used to or been exposed to it before. Now we have to put all those pride, everything aside and blend in to be like these people.
Put your childhood away because this is a different world.
Exactly. Mm. So it was a little bit tough because with both of our parents, even though we were speaking Lingala, but we were speaking French. So now you transition now into this new life. Now you have to speak Sango, because a lot of the kids do not speak French. So now you have to meet them at their level. So it was a little bit challenging, but thank God we adjust and we blend in. And
children do. I mean, it's amazing what children have to adjust to.
Mm-hmm.
Theo, were you able to have a childhood at all? I mean, you described running from gunfire while your mother's cutting the cord on your little sister when you were three. I don't know. What do you do after that?
So, like I said earlier, thank God I don't remember any of it. But so 99% of what I remember was in the camp, refugee camp. From 1996 to all the way to 2008, the beginning of 2008. So about, I'll say 12 years. Something like that. I mean, to now that's all I knew. So it was normal to me. Playing with friends, going to the market, where my dad worked, going to
In the refugee camp?
Yeah, now we are all together. We other than, some sibling, but like now, parents wise and some of the siblings, we are all together now. Everything is normal now. And we're in the refugee camp where there are Burundians in there. So it was normal at the time. I didn't know how we got there, but it was normal. And but I had the only difficult time I had like in the beginning of my childhood is because, like I said, I was born in Rwanda, and so then I spoke Kinyarwanda. And Kirundi, they're kind of similar, but when you know those two languages, you know the difference. So when we got to the camp, and 99% of the refugees are Burundians, and the children, everybody, and I'm speaking Kinyarwanda on them, and they were just making fun of me as if I don't know how to speak Kirundi, because they, like I said, they're very similar. Like, what kind of Kirundi is that? And then and that's how I became an expert to speak Kirundi now. But those are the only difficult thing I can remember. But at the time, even now, like, that was so normal to me.
Yeah, the fact that you used the word normal in the same sentence as a refugee camp.
Yeah.
That was normal.
It was normal. I didn't start questioning things like, wow. Until I spent a few years here, that's when I started looking back like, wow, there's other people that are living a certain life where you think, I don't think it's fair,
right?
But it's reality.
How old were you when that you started to reflect on what you'd been through?
So 5 years ago, I'll say. Yeah, it took me a while. Yeah.
Yeah. That was like a lifetime in a way.
Yes.
When you experienced that kind of profound.
Yeah. And then period. when I went back, when I went to Burundi in 2022, and there are a lot of people living in those conditions, and seeing how life shifted is I still don't understand it. Yeah.
What was that like to step back into that world? You must have been overwhelmed with emotion.
I was, but the weirdest thing happened. It was I was like, wow, I'm home. Like I say, like it was normal. Like you go to certain places, and like, wow, I'm home. But you also know, like, this is not fair to these people.
Yeah, but that, yeah, to say that that was home.
Yeah.
To have the conjure up that feeling and you're in a refugee camp.
Yeah.
That really messes with your head, I would think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So when did you start to feel, this is a question for both of you, when did you start to feel after you came to the United States, did it feel like you were finally somewhere safe, or was it still reflected, the life that you just left was reflected?
I would say we were excited when we got accepted to come here, because it was a way for us to kind of leave everything that happened behind and moved on to a new way of life and continue moving forward. And when we got here, I would say it was kind of a safety net for us. It was kind of like, okay, we don't have to look after our shoulder anymore. We don't have to worry about things like we used to.
That didn't happen overnight, though. I mean, I would imagine.
But it was much more better, much more safer now. It was more, okay, I can go to school without worrying that this month you're going to get kicked out because you didn't pay fees, you know, or you are not going to be able to allow to sit in class because they have to come call your name, that give you a paper, go tell your mom to pay this X amount before you can come in and take it.
Yeah.
And
being humiliated because you were poor.
Yeah.
Right.
So there is that, also knowing that, also just knowing that, okay, now this is a future, like, you know, it's now time to focus in school, because with everything that happened, we lost some years, so now let's cut up and focus school and move on and try to do something better with our life.
Wow. Yeah. What about you, Theo?
I was very naive, well, from what I remember. But I also knew this country was better than where I just came from. And I had this thing. This thing, I'm sure a lot of people have experienced it. Like, you know, people that came here as refugees had this thing like, wow, now I can do something about my country. Which I was very naive.
So now in the United States, I can do something that will eventually serve my country?
That's what I thought at the moment, yeah, at the time. And then the goal is, okay, I'll go to high school. even if after high school, you work, even though you're not making a lot of money, is way more than where you just came from. So you know you can literally send a child to school for a whole year. Just a few dollars. And then college, and like, oh, I want to, you know, political science. I want to do international this, international that. And then life hits you.
Well, life is, what is it? John Lennon said, life is what happens while you're making other plans.
Yeah, so it hits you like, okay.
But your life is not over. You're 30, so you still got some years.
That's true.
On that dream. You know?
I feel like one thing. I feel like the approach. I hope I come up with a better approach when it comes to that. Yeah.
So you both, when you came to the United States, did you come to Denver? Was this where you started your new life?
Yes.
So when did you guys first meet?
High school, the first year in the United States. So the first few months.
So both of you come from this shell shock of an experience.
Yes.
When did you start sharing what had happened to you? Or was that something you even talked about?
So, you know, it was interesting. We never share it. I mean, some of the stories, we talked about it, but like after, like, wait, like
maybe
two or three.
College, yeah, we so got married.
And that's because, you know, I'm asking questions. But then it's like, there was this weird feeling like we all, like, we just thought we knew each other and, you know, we never asked questions. Like, oh, where you come from? Like, we knew, like, oh, you come from Congo. But it's like the story, like, oh, how did you get here? It never occurred to, well, at least for me, to ask somebody. I just felt like I knew the person, mm-hmm. You know.
Was it something you didn't ask? Was that part of it? That you just left it alone because of what you'd been through?
Yes.
Yeah, and I think a lot of us do share that similar background of those type of event, whether it happened the same year or different part of continent you were, kind of, especially in those region of eastern part of Congo, a lot of the things that happen tend to happen in the same period of time. Like, so it's like if you are leaving Congo, then Rwanda is hitting, then Burundi, so it kind of is following each other. So if one person says I'm from Burundi, you automatically know, okay, probably you went to what happened in Burundi. If someone says I'm from Rwanda, you automatically assume and know that you went to that to come here, and you came from Congo, but you're from Rwanda. Okay, now I know why. So you automatically know all those stories. So
in a way, yes, you know, I don't necessarily want to open that door for you.
Exactly.
It's not my business.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, now I understand why. Well, thanks for telling me, and I hope I didn't cross any boundaries. But
oh, no, yeah. You didn't. And actually, this is the first time we have friends that we've known for years, and I'm sure this is going to be the first time they hear majority of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm overwhelmed and touched and sorry that you had to experience this.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I guess I would just encourage you to use this vehicle that to model and to bring people who feel comfortable and courageous enough to talk about some of these things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah,
thank you, Walter.
Hopefully next time we'll be asking you questions.
No, that's why.
Because I'm interested in how your family got here.
So we'll do that.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. No. Thank you so much. It was a new experience. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for agreeing to this. Yeah.
Likewise.
Yeah. Thank you. Really needed it.
A free therapy session.
No. I am humbled and probably naive, you know, so some of the advice, like the talking circles, I realize how naive that sounds given what you guys have been through. Mm-hmm. So you know best what you need to do.
Yeah.
Carry on.
No, thank you.
Yeah, all right. Thank you, Walter.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for watching Nyuki. Don't forget to share, subscribe, like, and yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.